So we're delving into neural pathways, the brain's intricate communication network.
Right, these highways of the mind, essentially.
Exactly. It all begins with neurons, the brain's fundamental units.
And their axons, those long, slender projections, are key, right?
They are. Axons transmit information, like electrical wires, bundled together to form tracks.
Like the optic tract, connecting eye to brain. Fascinating.
Precisely. It's a prime example of a neural pathway, enabling vision.
So these pathways are crucial for neurotransmission.
Absolutely. They allow different parts of the nervous system to talk.
And this communication is a two-way street, I imagine?
Indeed. We have ascending pathways carrying sensory information from the body to the brain.
And descending pathways controlling movement from brain to body makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Think of the pyramidal tracks sending motor signals from the cortex to the spinal cord.
Oh, so that's how we initiate actions?
Exactly. It's a complex interplay of signals, enabling coordinated movement.
And where do these pathways reside within the brain itself?
Well, shorter pathways are found in the gray matter, involved in local processing.
While longer pathways, forming the white matter, connect distant regions. I see.
Yes, and the myelin sheaths around axons in white matter speed up signal transmission.
Like insulation on a wire, making the signal travel faster.
A perfect analogy. Now let's talk about the hippocampus.
Oh, the memory center, right? How do pathways play a role there?
The hippocampus has its own intricate circuitry, with pathways like the perform pathway.
Which connects the entorhinal cortex to the hippocampal formation, if I recall correctly.
Impressive. You're absolutely right. This pathway is essential for memory formation.
It's like the gateway to long-term storage, isn't it?
Precisely. Now, how are these pathways named, you might wonder? Well, early anatomists during the Renaissance named them based on appearance.
Ah, like the corpus callosum, that bridge between hemispheres?
Exactly. Or the pyramidal tract, named for its shape in the medulla.
But these names don't tell us much about their function, do they?
No. Later, a more functional naming convention emerged, based on origin and termination.
So the nigrostriatal pathway, for instance, goes from substantia nigra to striatum.
You got it. This tells us where the pathway starts and ends, providing more context.
And sometimes, both naming conventions are used, like with the pyramidal tract.
Right. It's also called the lateral corticospinal tract, reflecting its origin and termination.
So within the cerebellum, we have mossy fibers and climbing fibers forming distinct pathways?
Yes, these pathways contribute to the cerebellum's role in motor control.
It's all quite intricate, isn't it? How do these pathways actually function?
Well, neurons receive information at their dendrites or cell bodies.
And the axon transmits this information over long distances, forming the core of the pathway.
Precisely. And the presence or absence of myelin affects the pathway's appearance.
Myelinated axons create the white matter, while unmyelinated ones appear gray.
Yes. Now, some neurons have remarkably long axons conveying information across significant distances.
Like the sciatic nerve running from the toe to the spinal cord, the longest axon in the human body.
Quite remarkable. These are archetypal examples of neural pathways in action.
And dopamine plays a crucial role in regulating these pathways, particularly in the basal ganglia.
Indeed. Dopamine pathways are involved in controlling behavior, motivation, and reward.
So it's not just about transmitting information, but also modulating and organizing these pathways.
Exactly. Dopamine fine-tunes the system, ensuring proper functioning.
It's a fascinating interplay of structure and function, shaping our thoughts and actions.
So we were talking about dopamine's role, right, in regulating neural pathways.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. It's like a conductor orchestrating the flow of information.
Exactly. But, you know, there's so much more to this story, like how these pathways change over time. That's neuroplasticity, right?
Right. The brain's ability to adapt and reorganize, it's not fixed, it's dynamic.
Exactly. And, you know, one area where this is really evident is in aging. Unfortunately, there's an increase in cortical DNA damage as we age.
Oh. So, like, wear and tear on the brain's genetic material?
Yeah. Likely oxidative DNA damage, particularly in gene promoters, and reactive oxygen species, or ROS, seem to play a significant role.
ROS? I've heard of those. Aren't they involved in, like, cell damage?
They are, but they also have a role in regulating synaptic plasticity and cognitive function. It's a double-edged sword.
I see. So while essential, too much ROS can be detrimental.
Precisely. Age-related increases in ROS can lead to impairments in these very functions.
So it's a delicate balance. What about factors that might enhance neuroplasticity?
Well, one fascinating area is multilingualism.
Oh, learning multiple languages? How does that affect the brain?
Numerous studies show that multilingual individuals have enhanced cognitive functions and flexibility.
Really? Like, what kind of enhancements?
Longer attention spans, stronger organizational and analytical skills, even a better theory of mind.
That's impressive. So how does learning languages achieve this?
It's all about neuroplasticity. Studies using voxel-based morphometry, or VBM, have shown structural changes in the brains of multilinguals.
VBM? That sounds like a brain imaging technique.
It is. It allows us to visualize brain structure. And studies have shown increased gray matter density in the inferior parietal cortex of multilinguals.
The inferior parietal cortex? Isn't that involved in language processing?
Exactly. And interestingly, early bilinguals show even greater density in this region compared to late bilinguals.
So the earlier you learn a second language, the greater the impact?
It seems so. And it's not just gray matter. Diffusion tensor imaging, or DTI, shows changes in white matter too.
White matter? That's the stuff connecting different brain regions, right?
Yes. And multilinguals, especially those actively using multiple languages, show increased white matter intensity, suggesting greater connectivity.
So the brain adapts to the demands of juggling multiple languages.
Precisely. It's like building more efficient communication networks within the brain.
Fascinating. So are these changes due to genetics or environment?
It's still debated, but evidence suggests that environmental and social experiences, particularly in early multilinguals, play a significant role.
So nurture over nature, perhaps?
Possibly. Now let's shift gears a bit and talk about depression. Traditionally, it's been viewed through the lens of monoamine imbalance.
Monoamines? Those are neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine, right?
Yes. But while traditional antidepressants increase these neurotransmitters quickly, their clinical effect is often delayed.
Oh? So there's a lag between the chemical change and the mood improvement?
Exactly. And this led researchers to explore other pathways, particularly those involved in neuroplasticity.
So the brain's ability to change might be key to treating depression?
It appears so. Studies have found a strong link between synapse number and depression severity. Fewer synapses, more severe symptoms.
That makes sense. So how do antidepressants fit into this?
Well, it turns out that traditional antidepressants do improve neuroplasticity, but over a much longer time course, weeks or even months.
So that explains the delayed effect. Are there faster-acting treatments?
Yes. Ketamine, for instance, has shown rapid antidepressant effects after a single infusion.
Ketamine? Isn't that an anesthetic?
It is, but it also rapidly increases dendritic spines and restores functional connectivity, key aspects of neuroplasticity.
So it kickstarts the brain's rewiring process.
Precisely. And other compounds, like serotonergic psychedelics and scopolamine, have shown similar rapid and enduring effects.
So it's a whole new approach to treating depression, focusing on neuroplasticity.
So we were discussing how traditional antidepressants, while increasing neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine quickly, often have a delayed clinical effect.
Right. And that lag led to exploring neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to adapt and reorganize as a key factor in treating depression.
Exactly. And the connection between synapse number and depression severity is striking. Fewer synapses correlate with more severe symptoms.
So restoring those connections becomes crucial. And ketamine, despite being an anesthetic, seems to do just that, rapidly increasing dendritic spines and restoring functional connectivity.
Yeah, it's like a jump start for the brain's rewiring process. And other compounds, like serotonergic psychedelics and scopolamine, show similar rapid and enduring effects on neuroplasticity.
It's a paradigm shift in treating depression. Now, this neuroplasticity, it's not just about depression, is it?
No, not at all. It plays a role in many aspects of brain function, including how we learn and adapt to new situations. And one area where this is particularly evident is in language acquisition, especially multilingualism.
Oh, interesting. So learning multiple languages actually changes the brain's structure?
It does. Studies using voxel-based morphometry, or VBM, show increased gray matter density in the inferior parietal cortex of multilinguals.
VBM? That's a brain imaging technique, right?
Yes. It allows us to visualize brain structure. And the inferior parietal cortex is heavily involved in language processing.
So the more languages you speak, the denser this region becomes?
It seems so. And early bilinguals show even greater density compared to late bilinguals.
So early exposure really makes a difference. What about the connections between brain regions? Does that change too?
Yes. Diffusion tensor imaging, or DTI, reveals changes in white matter, the stuff connecting different brain regions.
And what does DTI show in multilinguals?
Increased white matter intensity, suggesting greater connectivity, especially in those actively using multiple languages.
So the brain adapts to the demands of juggling multiple languages by building more robust communication networks?
Precisely. It's like upgrading the brain's infrastructure. Now, whether these changes are primarily due to genetics or environment is still debated.
Nature versus nurture, the classic debate. But it sounds like environment, especially early experiences, plays a significant role.
Possibly. It's a complex interplay. Now, shifting gears a bit, let's talk about adenosine, a neurotransmitter involved in various cellular processes, including synaptic transmission.
Adenosine? Isn't that related to caffeine?
It is. Caffeine acts as an adenosine receptor antagonist, blocking its effects.
So caffeine essentially disrupts adenosine signaling.
Exactly. And adenosine, primarily a neuromodulator, acts through two main G-protein-coupled receptors, A1 and A2A.
GPCRs again, so it's modulating rather than directly transmitting signals.
Yes. And interestingly, acute alcohol exposure seems to increase adenosine signaling.
Oh, how did that happen?
It appears to involve inhibiting a nucleoside transporter that normally removes adenosine from the synapse.
So alcohol keeps adenosine around longer, amplifying its effects?
Precisely. And chronic alcohol exposure leads to a downregulation of A2A receptors and a decrease in their signaling.
A compensatory mechanism, perhaps, to counteract the increased adenosine from acute alcohol use.
So, we were talking about neuroplasticity and its role in depression, right? But it's involved in so much more than that.
Yeah, it affects how we learn, adapt, even language acquisition, especially in multilingual people.
Exactly. Studies using voxel-based morphometry, or VBM, show increased gray matter density in a specific part of the brain.
Hmm.
VBM? That's a brain imaging technique?
It is. It lets us see brain structure. And in multilinguals, the inferior parietal cortex involved in language processing is denser.
So, more languages, denser brain region? Fascinating.
And early bilinguals show even greater density than late bilinguals. Early exposure matters.
What about connections between brain regions? Do those change too?
Yes. Diffusion tensor imaging, DTI, shows changes in white matter, which connects different brain regions.
And what does it show in multilinguals?
Increased white matter intensity, suggesting greater connectivity, especially if they actively use multiple languages.
So the brain adapts by building stronger communication networks, like upgrading the brain's infrastructure?
Precisely. Now, is this nature or nurture? It's debated, but early experiences seem to play a big role.
So nurture might be more important? Interesting. Now, what about adenosine?
Adenosine, a neurotransmitter, is involved in various cellular processes, including synaptic transmission.
Hmm.
Isn't that related to caffeine?
It is. Caffeine blocks adenosine's effects. It's an adenosine receptor antagonist.
So caffeine disrupts adenosine signaling. Got it.
Adenosine acts through two main G-protein coupled receptors. A1 and A2A. It's neuromodulator.
Modulating, not directly transmitting. Okay.
And acute alcohol exposure increases adenosine signaling.
Oh? How so?
It inhibits a transporter that removes adenosine from the synapse, so alcohol keeps adenosine around longer.
Amplifying its effects. I see.
Chronic alcohol exposure, though, leads to downregulation of A2A receptors and decreased signaling.
A compensatory mechanism, maybe, to counteract the acute alcohol effect?
So, we've been delving into this fascinating world of neural pathways, haven't we? It's like exploring the brain's intricate highway system.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling how complex it all is. From the simplest reflexes to our most complex thoughts, it all boils down to these pathways.
Exactly. And what's really striking is this concept of neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to constantly adapt and rewire itself. It's not a fixed entity, it's dynamic, always changing.
Right, and that's where things get really interesting because it means we're not stuck with the neural pathways we're born with. We can actually change them, create new ones. It's like constantly upgrading our brain's operating system.
Precisely. And this has profound implications for, well, everything. Learning, memory, even recovering from brain injuries. It's like the brain has this amazing capacity for self-repair.
Yeah, and what's really cool is how Simple actions can contribute to this rewiring process, like just changing your route to work or learning a new song can create new synaptic connections.
It's the small things that add up, you know? And it's not just about learning new things, it's also about reinforcing existing pathways, making them stronger. It's like maintaining those highways, keeping them clear and efficient.
Right, and repetition is key, like practicing a musical instrument or learning a new language. The more you use a pathway, the stronger it becomes.
Exactly. It's like the more traffic a highway gets, the wider it becomes. And the less you use it, the more likely it is to, well, fade away.
So use it or lose it, as they say. But it's not just about repetition. It's also about intensity and the meaning we attach to what we're learning. If something is truly important to us, we're more likely to remember it.
Precisely. It's like if a road leads to somewhere you really want to go, you're more likely to take it. And the more you take it, the more familiar it becomes.
And this whole concept of neuroplasticity has huge implications for education, too. If students understand that their intelligence isn't fixed, that they can literally change their brains by learning, it can be incredibly empowering.
Absolutely. It's like giving them the tools to build their own highways, to shape their own minds. And that's incredibly powerful.
It really is. And it's not just about academics. It's about, well, everything. Our ability to adapt to new situations, to overcome challenges, to grow as individuals. It all comes down to this amazing capacity for neuroplasticity.
Well, folks, that's about all the time we have for today's episode. We've journeyed through the intricate world of neural pathways, exploring how these remarkable networks shape our thoughts, actions, and everything in between. It's been a fascinating exploration, and I hope you've gained a deeper appreciation for the incredible plasticity of your own brain. Until next time, keep those neural pathways firing, and goodbye from me.
And from me, too. Thanks for listening, everyone.